Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, and our thanks to Ollie Slack for the football. Now it's time for an hour of food and drink, and our congratulations to Vanderlyle in Mill Road for their listing in the Good Food Guide, which is wildly impressive. Alan Alder's away, so the Flavour team today is Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman.
And on today's Flavour, foraging with Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester.
Almost like they've got a white coating on, a white dusting over them, say. But they're absolutely wonderful at this time of year and a real treat.
Signorelli's, the Italian delicatessen in Burley Street, is opening a new branch.
It took me a while to come up with the concept, and I think standing back here now, when the lights have just come on, we've done a great job, and now it's just a case of just seeing if our customers, if Cambridge like it.
A wine bar and shop has opened just off of Milton Road, selling English and Welsh wines.
We've actually got over 160 English and Welsh wines on our shelves now, which is the most of anyone in the entire country. We have the largest stock.
We also visit Battered and enjoy their handmade donuts on the Cambridge Market.
We went to Ipswich Market, and in the first day, by about 2 o'clock, we'd sold out 400 donuts. You know, we were so happy and just so proud, and it was just like, do you know what? Maybe we can do this.
And Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille Publishing is here to talk about three new cookbooks.
My children like these sweets that are called like super sours, but they love the excitement of that feeling in your mouth, like right at the back of your mouth. I think it's really interesting that it's coming back.
And you can contact us anytime by texting 07919 070490. Or you can email us anytime on flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or send us a tweet to @flavour105. Tequila!
So, let's begin. First off the blocks is a new Italian eatery with a familiar name, and it's just opened in the Grafton.
In the news this week, we've had the announcement of Don Pasquale closing in Market Square. Now, that was the first Italian restaurant to open in Cambridge back in 1973, so sad news, obviously. But since its opening, there has, of course, been many Italian restaurants across the city, and Italian cuisine is still one of the most popular of the restaurant sector, and perhaps reflected here with Alex Signorelli and his success with Signorelli's Deli on Burley Street. Now we are here at the new site on the Grafton.
Yeah, so welcome to La Piazza.
What a gorgeous spot. It's front and centre.
It's right in the square itself of the Grafton, of the new sort of redeveloped food social, the new food court for the entire shopping centre. So we're stepping away from what we're renowned for, which is our focaccias and pizzas and ciabattas. Yeah. With La Piazza, the whole concept is the ability of just literally grabbing a really nice cocktail or a really nice craft beer from Cambridge. So we've paired up with Brewboards or a artisan brewery in Italy, back in my hometown of Bergamo, alongside other craft beers, but they're going to be the main feature, and also having a draft pint, should we say, inside the shopping centre. Anything that we serve, from the food to the alcohol, you'll actually be able to take home with you that day. Mm. Any spirits that we use making cocktails, you can actually buy that spirit to take home with you. So we've paired up with quite a few small independent producers of spirits, and we're going to be using them. And like I said, there'll be a point where you can actually buy it and take home with you.
Per sentire una canzone con te ed averti solamente per me.
You don't strike me as having a very strong Italian accent, for one thing.
I was born and raised in Italy. I moved over when I was about 12. So my third generation restaurateurs. My granddad started off having his own bar in Bergamo. My dad and my other two uncles are professional pizzoli chefs. I decided not to follow in their footsteps. But yeah, here we are, 15 years down the line, actually going back to my roots.
So what triggered it for you eventually?
Do you know what? I've always had a passion for food. I remember when I was a little growing up in Italy and my dad had restaurants over there. He would always take me to the local farms. He believed a buying a source. So he'd go and explore the countryside and he would explore the best farmers who looked after the best animals and the best welfare that carried the best flavour, not only from sort of the meat and the fish, but also the vegetables. And that really passed on to me when I sort of became an adult, to the point that even for Signorelli's, the bakery, and here is actually doing most of my importing myself. So I go back to Italy and actually select the produce just like what my dad did. Mm.
Now you're from Bergamo, which is northern Italy.
Spot on.
Quite a difference between northern and southern Italian food, for example.
So for instance, our bakers are from the north, so from Liguria and Genoa, where the focaccia actually comes from. But then we've got chefs from Sicily, so therefore we try and match it together so to please the north and south. our ice creams, our gelato, actually comes from the same ice cream parlour I grew up, that I used to go there when I was 4 years old to buy ice cream. We actually import them now directly. I grew up with them, you know, 25, 30 years later, we now bring their ice creams over. Because not only I buy most of my products from Italy, but then I revert back to the fresh products locally as well. The greens, the peppers, and the vegetables, they try and get as local a source as possible as well. And then start to bring in specialised chefs from Sicily to start doing the arancini. So we make our arancini fresh every morning. The bread that we have is actually made fresh every morning, 7 days a week. So the bakers actually come in, bless their soul, at 4 o'clock in the morning to make sure we get the freshest products for our customers, really.
Yes, yeah.
So a lot of people have asked me, where does this project, La Piazza, come about? And it's about me travelling around and going back to Italy a lot and visiting a lot of airports and always seeing that you always had a kiosk specialising in either the ice creams, the sandwiches or the food, as well as the bar. And it was that element about trying to merge all three together as well into one outlet. Yeah. But that's what I really wanted to try and create. For someone that arrived at the Grafton Shopping Centre, they'd either want an ice cream for the kids or themselves, yeah, some street food at lunchtime, or do you know what, just put the feet up and just enjoy a good glass of wine. And that's why here at Piazza we'll be serving not only Italian, because we're going to be branching out for the first time into Mediterranean food. Portugal, we'll cover Spain with the tapas, we'll cover Italy, but we'll also cover a bit of Greece. So we're introducing some kind of the fettas, the Greek salads, the moussakas, and also will be reflected in the wines from small family independent wineries as well. With three different counters to have its own identity, the food, the gelato, or whether or not it's the alcohol side of it. Uh-huh. So therefore you won't have to queue for very long. We're actually going to keep the pizzas, the what we're renowned for at Signorelli's, while at Piazza, we're going to do something completely different. Although we are a cocktail bar that we were open till 11 o'clock at night, we're also at the front going to be introducing all the wonderful, fresh, healthier products. So for anyone that loves carbohydrates, they'll go to Signorelli's. Yeah. Anyone that loves greens, vegetables, seafood salads, pasta salads, and are trying to look after what they eat in a sense of calorie intake, they'll all come to La Piazza.
So a nice clear distinction there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we're going to keep it completely separate. We're still going to be selling our own breads on both sides, and you can still get a gourmet sandwich. We're also looking to bring an Italian traditional bread from one of the beautiful areas of Italy, called Emilia Romagna, which is La Piadina, which is an Italian flatbread. Oh. So it's a flatbread that is then toasted. Inside of it is a wonderful meats and cheeses, again from all Italy. And that's one of the things that we'll be bringing over to La Piazza as well.
You were recently nominated for England's Best Newcomer as well as Best Pizza 2018 in England's Italian Awards.
Yeah, absolutely. So recently we've gone through to the final selections for the British Food Awards, the best cafe stroke bistro in Great Britain. But just the fact to be nominated, it's absolutely wonderful to see that our customers are actually taking their time out to put our names forward to that. But that not only comes through to me, but it's my chefs as well, it's my staff. So thank you all for that. You know, if you go to a cafe, if you go to a restaurant, you want to make sure you get looked after well. You know, one thing I do spend a lot of time is training and ability to actually, for my own staff, to have the same passion as I have on food. And my dad always looked after his chef and his restaurants because they are the driving force. If you are willing and you are looking forward to coming to work, then you come to work with passion. And that's what we want. So a little bit of info about La Piazza and how actually the word La Piazza came out about. It's because we're located in the square of the shopping centre. La Piazza in Italian means the square. And the ethos has always been around the fact that when you go to a square in Italy, you'd always find a little shop that would sell the gelato, the ice cream, and the cafeteria, the coffees. You'd also find a little shop that sells sort of kind of street food element, and then another shop that would sell the bar, the alcohol. And that's where this project's come, is the ability to literally arrive at La Piazza, just like you're arriving at a square, which is all open plan. We've got no walls, so we're literally in the square of the shopping centre. And therefore, that's why we offer street food, so the food Italian side of it. We then have a counter dedicated to Italian pasticcini, so cakes, as well as ice creams, the gelato. We import directly back from my hometown in Bergamo. And also a counter dedicated to bars. So that's where the actual element of going in and having a little glass of wine or a cocktail comes. And that's where La Piazza was born.
And also little streetlights, which I think have just been turned on for the very first time.
They are indeed, yeah. The electrician's on site, so we should be open. And by the time this goes out, we will be open.
Lovely. Well, Alessandro, it's been great to meet you. All the best. I'm sure it will be a fantastic success.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you everyone for coming to see us and voting us. And please come again.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Yeah, that was Alex Signorelli, and his business is the latest entrant to the Grafton's food social area. Now, this is a special section towards the end of the Grafton where you'll find interesting independents like Signorelli's. And upstairs, there's also Amelie Floncouche, who are featured in the programme back on the 13th of April. And you can hear that feature anytime via our podcast service. So that's a nice, lovely, shameless plug there.
There's news of free food available now Saturday in Cambridge. You can find this information on the Olio app. If you're listening to a repeat or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available. The app is free to download.
Yeah, and looking at Olio today, we see that Kimberly, she has a kilogram of whole grain and half a kilogram of self-raising flour to give away. She's based over by the river, just off Scotland Road and near the Green Dragon pub, if you're familiar with that one. John has free fresh mint, loads of it. Come and pick up as much as you need, he says. And John and his abundance of mint are on Coldham's Lane, where it meets with Vinery Road. And then finally, Eleanor. She has some South African peri-peri seasoning, like a big grinderful, like a pepper mill. And she's by the river too. It's near the big Tesco on Newmarket Road. Now, that's just a few of the things that are available on Olio right now. And just keep checking it through the days, especially over the weekdays. There's plenty going on there. And also an extra mention to... there are food outlets in and around Cambridge which sell plenty of, they sell any unsold goods that they have shortly before they close, and they do this using the Too Good to Miss app. Now, that's also free to download.
Now is the time of year that publishers start to release their autumn books. Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille has been talking to Alan about three of their new books, starting with Sour by Mark Diacono. Alan began by congratulating Sarah on the numerous awards some of their books gained earlier in the year.
We had a really good year at Quadrille, yeah. Caroline Eden's Black Sea, which I think I've talked about to you before, won practically every award going. And it's so lovely to have our books recognised within the industry.
Well, I think some of these are going to be up for awards.
So.
The first one, Mark Diacono, Sour. Could you tell us a bit about what it's about?
Yes, it's about the incredible flavour that is sourness. And remarkably, it's something that I think people assume they don't like. And then when you start thinking about how essential and transformative it can be as a flavour, it's really quite extraordinary. And there's been a move in recent years towards food stuff, I think, that are based around sourness. If you think about sourdough bread, for one thing, it's probably the most obvious example, but sour beers, things like kimchi in terms of pickling and preserves, shrubs in terms of drinks, kombucha, yogurts. I think when we first talked about it, we realised that it was cropping up everywhere after years of everybody wanting sweetness. He's examined sour as a flavour. He's examined the methods and the processes whereby you make things like vinegar and yogurt. And the first, I think it's probably about the first quarter of the book, maybe not quite, is that whole introduction talking about sourness. And then the rest of the book are recipes whereby you can use the things you've made.
Yeah, when we think about sour, we think of our mouths puckering up and perhaps not a great experience. But then he points out that the sort of sweets that people, I don't know what sweets people eat nowadays, but I mean, there used to be things like, you know, lemon drops and so on.
Yeah.
And we used to love them, and it is the sourness, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, my children like these sweets that are called like super sours.
Right.
Yeah, they really love, but they love the excitement of that feeling in your mouth, like right at the back of your mouth. I think it's really interesting how it's coming back.
And sugar can, I mean, although I think sugar can bring out the flavour of things, it can also blanket the flavour of things, can't it?
Yeah, it's sort of, I think Mark says in the intro, it's too easy to love sugar. It's sort of, it's no challenge, whereas, you know, sour is more gradual and subtle and nuanced.
a quiet pleasure. And in this introductory part, he talks about some ingredients that impart sourness, and some quite unusual ones there.
I guess, yes, I mean, he wanted to be completely thorough. I mean, you might not tackle making these things yourself, but I mean, I think there's certainly ingredients you could find just thinking around the corner at at Mill Road, I'm sure you could find things like the dried mango powder. And I think these things are much more widely available than they used to be.
But I mean, that's one of the things that makes the book exciting, actually, because it leads you to trying these things, well, you know, like black limes.
Yes. Well, I certainly hope so. And, you know, his recipes are very, very accessible. There's nothing challenging, really, about the recipes. And, I think he just wants to encourage people to experiment with flavour and maybe try things that they might have assumed that they didn't like.
Yeah. And again, in the beginning of the book, he sort of talks about, I suppose, basic souring skills that you would use to make. I mean, you've mentioned sourdough and yoghurt, but creme fraiche, vinegar, verjuice. And then the second part, you actually employ either those skills or the things you've made in the recipes. Drinks in there as well.
Quite a lot of drinks, yeah. Mark mentioned that one of his favourites is a ginger rosemary Tom Collins. And he says, it's so, so lemony. He says, it should feel as if someone has taken your teeth out while you were asleep, polished them, put them back in and slapped you awake. After one, you feel you can do anything. After two, you can do nothing.
Gosh. But things like water kefir, which I've not come across.
No, I've never had water kefir, I have to say.
Right, well, with this book, you can have, yeah. And some nice recipes. As you said, you know, not necessarily difficult to make, but things you might not have thought of. Rhubarb and radish salad.
Yes, the salads are really lovely.
And looks wonderful as well.
He's got I think it's rojak, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, but that's a sort of Southeast Asian salad, which has got mango and papaya and radish, pineapple. And it's just, that shows how well the sort of hotness, that kind of chili heat, goes with, you know, sour flavours. I think there are some really exciting and original recipes in here.
There are actually some quite old recipes in there as well. For example, Sussex Pond Pudding, which I made a long time ago, and you put a whole lemon in the middle of...
That's right,
surround it with about a ton of butter.
There's also a fabulous trifle in there. I'm a bit of a trifle fan. And, he's got a recipe that's Grandad's Trifle, and it uses Christmas pudding as a sort of, or Christmas cake as a spongy element, and then you have plums, roast plums to go in it as well. That's pretty incredible.
That does sound good. Does he say that he has any favourites, or have you mentioned the favourites?
I think one of Mark's favourites is the ceviche, which is passion fruit, grapefruit and pomegranate, because it's just so refreshing and it's so flavourful. One of the reasons I like that recipe is that his intro is so amazing to that. He just talks about this story of when he got lost, when he was walking on the South Downs, and he ended up walking 30 miles. So he talks about carrying two rucksacks and a misread bus timetable, and then sort of arriving at a friend's house at the end of it and being shown wordlessly to the fridge and to some absolutely stone-cold chilled beers and just sort of necking them after this massive walk. But it's what I love Mark's writing, and I love how there's a personal element to everything, and it's so evocative. You know, you sort of see that description of that experience of having something so cold and refreshing, and immediately you understand what he means about the ceviche.
It excites me. Mackerel, gooseberry salsa and horseradish butter.
That's quite a combination, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's so innovative.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's sour. And Mark still runs Otter Farm, does he?
He doesn't run Otter Farm anymore, actually. He did for many years, and he still... he does quite a lot of gardening writing, and I think he's been on Garden as well. That's the food side and the gardening side as well, which of course came together in Otter Farm.
So is that book Sour, is that published now?
It is. It was out in September.
And the second one that you've got is by Catherine Phipps, and it's called Leaf. And she had a very good book out, was it a year, 2 years ago, called Citrus?
It's nearly 2 years ago. It's Citrus, yes. And Leaf, I guess, takes the same idea that it's an ingredient or a type of ingredient that is so important in culinary terms. and so versatile and varied. And Catherine's a fantastic researcher and recipe writer. She's so thorough. She's so meticulous. And I don't know if there will ever be a definitive book of all culinary leaves, but this is certainly a fantastic look at every kind of leaf you can think of, really. Mm. And probably some that you hadn't heard of.
Oh, there are plenty I haven't heard of. yes, well, this research, it really comes across in the book. I mean, she talks about going to Chinatown and buying leaves. You might not know what they are, but and she talks also about noticing a flavour in restaurants and asking what it is, and almost being palmed off, really, and eventually discovering that it's a leaf called lasky, which not a leaf I'm familiar with.
No, I'd not heard of that before the book.
And she talks also about, you know, there's a reasonably big section on seaweeds as well, which, you know, again, to most of us are really are not very well-known, if not unknown, quantity. And I like the fact that she has apparently on her table, her dining table at home, a little pot of powdered seaweed. And you're encouraged to add it to your meal to see if it goes well or not.
Yeah, so, you know, seaweed salt on chips.
Yes, So, excellent, excellent research. And lots of recipes as well.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Which presumably are meticulously
tested, tested and retested. Yeah, she's an amazing recipe writer. And also, as I say, discovering these leaves that we hadn't previously heard of, but how versatile they are in terms of what you can do with them. Just thinking about things like, fig leaves, not just for wrapping. She uses them for infusions. There's a lovely fig leaf panna cotta whereby she infuses the milk with the fig leaf flavours. And then we talked quite a lot about how you just sort of start noticing fig trees everywhere. I walked from school this morning and I know there was a fig tree on the street that I hadn't noticed before. And then Catherine said when shooting the book, she noticed that there was one growing up the fire escape, sort of through a crack in the in the concrete. And things like vine leaves. Also, there's a sort of stray vine on my street that I notice. And they're all around. And I think Catherine started foraging a bit more as a result of writing this book, because she's discovered so many things she didn't know about. Or herbs that you might not have heard of, like ginger rosemary. She says ginger rosemary is her new favourite herb. I think the other interesting thing about Catherine's recipes and some of the ingredients is that she utilises parts of the plants that you would usually throw away. So it's a very kind of economical way of cooking. She uses broad bean tops in a salad, for instance, beet tops and things like that. She used down squash leaves, which you would never think of.
Yeah. And also, there's a recipe there for Swiss chard tart.
Yes.
Which is in the dessert section, isn't it?
I know. Isn't that intriguing?
Yeah. And she talks also about unusual pairings like crab and chervil, which she says goes very well.
Catherine's parents live in Greece, so I think there's quite a lot of influence, Greek influence, in many of her recipes. The Swiss chard tart is a Greek recipe. So when she visits, she tries lots of things and then takes influences home with her.
So Leaf, when is Leaf published?
It's publishing in October.
One of the things in Leaf, which I thought was a very useful summary, because most leaves aren't really around in the winter months, is ways of preserving them so that you can use them throughout the year.
Yeah.
So there's a section on things like, vinegars, herb jellies, butters.
Yeah.
You've mentioned salts. Freezing them. It's part of her experimentation, I suppose. Curry leaf vinegar. Great idea.
And she uses it a lot, yeah. But yes, as you say, things like chopping up herb stalks and freezing them, because obviously it's difficult to freeze leaves.
Yeah.
And then you still get that kind of intense, the flavour.
Yeah, it's still there, yeah.
And she uses herb butters a lot. Again, it's a really good way of getting flavour into a dish.
Anyway, that's Leaf by Catherine Phipps. Right, the last book we're going to look at today is Charred, and that's about Well, it's about barbecuing, but it's vegetables, isn't it?
It's vegetarian grilling and barbecue.
Right.
And lovely pun on the title chard, of course.
Indeed. So, yes, actually, I say indeed, I hadn't spotted it. Right, so what's in here then that's good?
Well, I think, I don't know whether it's the weather, but there's been quite a lot of interest in grilling and barbecue, been lots of publishing around it. But I think people tend to think it's usually burgers, steaks, etc., and not really so much about vegetables, while at the same time people are looking to cut down on their meat intake and maybe only eat meat a couple of times a week. And there's just this interest in vegetarian cooking. So, you know, Genevieve Taylor, who wrote this, she's a Bristol-based food writer. She'd been demoing at lots of festivals and events, and people were really interested most in her vegetarian dishes, and she was getting great feedback. So, you know, she worked on this book and wrote it incredibly quickly, actually, and it came out in May this year, and it's been doing fantastically well, I think, because there's just so little written around vegetarian barbecue.
Well, I think there's some, I mean, there are some recipes in there which just I just want to go out and try, you know, like, for example, well, there's lots of examples, but jerk spice plantain with shallots and halloumi just is wonderful. Harissa potatoes, halloumi and asparagus with coriander and lemon oil. They just sound great. But also, I suppose, ones which are really much, much simpler. There's smoked celeriac, which, you know, I just... I had the one time I've eaten at Midsummer House, we had that, and it was just divine.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, you wouldn't think celeriac could be that deep and profound in terms of flavour.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for celeriac. I think most of us haven't been getting the best out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's some really, really nice ideas. Yeah, smoked whole celeriac. It does take 3.5 to 4 hours to do.
There is,
but
that, yeah, another one is the smoked whole cauliflower with spiced garlic butter. That's amazing. Cauliflower has become one of those very sort of on-trend ingredients, I think. You know, people are now used to the concept of a cauliflower steak. But Jen does a whole cauliflower, and she just sort of, she bastes it in this amazing garlic butter, and it's absolutely incredible. I think that was a recipe when she was demoing. She got fantastic comments on that one.
And she also points out that a lot of the recipes in there you don't actually have to do on the barbecue.
You don't.
You can do
it
on the grill or griddle pan.
Yeah, a grill or griddle pan indoors. So you don't have to have the nice weather.
yeah. But, I mean, increasingly people are barbecuing outdoors in winter, aren't they?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and lots of the, you know, her recipes are cover all seasons, really. They're not all summery ones, although she's got lovely salads and things. But yes, as you say, some of those larger dishes like celeriac or cauliflower, you could just do them in her at home in the kitchen any time of the year, really.
Yeah, so a very useful book. Right, so that's Charred by Genevieve Taylor. Thanks very much, and presumably
you.
You're working on a whole new batch of books.
We're working on finishing spring 2020 titles and just starting on the autumn 2020. So,
oh, are you really?
Yeah, so a year and a bit ahead. Yeah.
It never stops. And you're still enjoying it by the look of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Top.
And that was Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille Publishing. And Sarah will be back to talk about another of Quadrille's new books next time.
Now on to our regular foraging feature with Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester, who is in a hedgerow in Grantchester Meadows.
Yeah, middle of September. Best thing really that is accessible to everybody is the hedgerows. So we're looking at the kind of the berries really now. So, well, the first thing that always comes to mind with hedgerows is blackberries. And they are in abundance. They're very safe to eat. I mean, other than eating too many of them and getting your dicky tummy, they're absolutely wonderful. And we all know what to do with those. Other things that we'd like to talk about at the moment is something called a dewberry. Now, we don't have them in the meadows here in Grantchester, but we do very close, only a mile or so away. They're basically like another kind of blackberry. Think of them like matte black.
with slightly bigger pods on them and less pods. They also grow at ankle height. So if you're walking through the woods, on the edges of the woodland anywhere and things like that, you find ankle-high brambles. They don't get very high. I've not seen them. I think the tallest maybe 2 foot high. Have a look for them. They're very obviously matte black. They've all got almost like they've got a white coating on, a white dusting over them, say. But they're absolutely wonderful at this time of year and a real treat.
Do they taste like blackberries or are they a more intense version?
They do. They taste very similar, but I'd say they're a little bit tartar and a tiny bit drier as well. I actually prefer them to blackberries. And yeah, they really are in abundance. If you walk around most woodlands, near the edges of most rivers at the moment, lots of things like that. Any rivers with woodland, really. So in the meadows next to the river, we don't have any brambles grown by there. But they're quite common at the moment and quite an easy find. And again, another nice, it's a European dewberry we're talking about here. So if you want to have a look at that on the internet, then that'll give you a good idea of what you're talking about.
What unusual things might you do with dewberries or blackberries?
So the dewberries this week, what we've done in the Green Man is we literally made a syrup out of them and we used it to glaze a pigeon dish. So really nice, nice sweet, tart, sour. Works really well, but anything you do with blackberries. So you can bake them into crumbles, make jams out of them, chutneys, pickles, preserves, flavour them in vinegars, gins, whatever your heart desires.
Do you have to wait till they're all black, or can you use them when they're red or green?
There are ways to use them when they're unripe, but I don't tend to. I do. I mean, you can lacto-ferment the ones when, well, we'll have a look at here. We've got the ones that are red here. They're quite tough and hard, but if you did lacto-ferment them for a while, that would work. But I tend to wait till they're black. I think, to be honest, they're one of the things that should just be used really simply.
Remind me what lacto-fermenting is. I know you've talked about fermenting before.
So it's where you're converting the lactic acid. It's a way of preserving, basically, using the bacteria in it and changing the sugars.
And how would you do that again?
We tend to brine things, so 3% brine.
Yeah.
And we preserve them in the same way we do other fermenting, so... Yeah, with brine, 3% brine, leave them, watch the bubbles work their magic.
Other things that are growing in the hedgerows at the moment that are coming to fruition?
Yeah, another great thing, both medicinally and flavoursome-wise, is rose hips. Really easy to identify. Most of us remember them as itching powder from being a child. Popping them open and pouring them down your mate's back.
Nice.
Yeah, whenever you use them, I mean, if you're making cordials out of them or syrups, they're really good, high in vitamin C, far more than any citrus fruit. So they're really, really good health benefits.
People used to have rose hip syrup. They used to give that to children, if I remember.
Yeah, it's good to keep away colds and things like that. There's quite a few other medicinal uses for it, which off the top of my head, I can't remember.
Fair enough.
We tend to make a lot of cordials out of them, and they're very good. In that case, with the cordials, you've got to strain it well through muslin afterwards, but you don't need to take the seeds out at the beginning.
Fair enough, because you don't want any of the fibery bits in there.
The reason why they're called itching powder is because the seeds have got tiny little hairs all over them. The seeds themselves aren't actually poisonous, but the hairs are really, really irritant, and you just wouldn't want them.
Not so nice.
You just wouldn't want them in you. But we make a lovely pickled syrup out of them, so we actually pickle them and then take the pickling liquor and reduce that right down, and that adds a lovely flavour as well. But or you can do a take on Turkish Delight, which is made normally classically out of the flowers, but you can also do it out of the hips and it gives it a lovely earthy quality as well.
I've never made Turkish Delight. How do you do it?
So Turkish Delight is basically, so classically you take rose water and gelatine, your icing sugar and everything to dust it. And you can do exactly the same, but with the hips, so you can make a rose hip cordial and do it that way around with your gelatines and everything.
And then as you said, it gives you more earthy flavours, but you could almost use it as a sort of savoury Turkish delight.
You could do, yes. Yeah, it's not something I've played around with, but there would be ways around that. Yeah, definitely.
Sounds very interesting. And so, apart from the blackberries and the rose hips, there's some other red things I can see in the hedgerows.
There is. It's another classic one that's easy for everyone to identify. It's the hawthorn. So we've talked about hawthorn before in the past. And we use the blossoms for things. We've used the leaves for things. Now we're coming up to the hawthorn berries. So what we're going to do with them, they lend themselves very well, basically, to jellies. It's a classic thing. And you can make it all with your hands by squeezing them. So you get them all in a bowl and give them a really good squeeze. Squeeze all the liquid out through a muslin cloth. And then that will actually set up firm like a classic jelly. And it's very easy to do. So you can do that with all the kids and play around with it. The seeds are poisonous, so you don't want to eat the seeds.
Right.
Hence why you strain them through muslin.
Right. And presumably they have a fair amount of pectin in them so that the jellies will set well.
Yeah, that's what it sets, yeah. But what we use them for, and it's going to be on our next menu in about 3 weeks' time, will be hot sauce. So we'll make like a hawthorn and chilli ketchup, and it makes a fantastic hot sauce. We'll use some of the wild food vinegars that we've made and use that to give a real acidity to it, but it makes a fantastic hot sauce. So that's worth coming down for at the beginning of October when we change our menu, ready for autumn.
That's what we're seeing in the meadows at the moment. Are there any other areas or any other foraging tips you'd be giving?
It is. At the moment, a good one to look out for is guelder rose. So we've just got a dish going on tonight with guelder rose. We make a syrup out of it. So you'll be looking again on the edge of woodlands. So if you're walking around big wide paths that have been mown into woodlands, have a look around. You've got red berries. The leaves kind of resemble the maple leaf in the sense they've got the 3 points on them. At this time of year, some of them will be green and some of them will just start going pink with the leaves. They do change as autumn comes on more. And the berries, really astringent, need a lot of sugar to work with, but have a lovely, lovely fresh berry flavour, I find, when you add the right amount of sugar. So at the moment, we've got a dish going on tonight with them, with the syrup that we do, with a nice pig's head little starter.
That's
it kind of
really
cuts through the fatty element of the brawn style pig's head terrine we've made.
Okay, well, that sounds really good. And presumably the guelder rose hips, are they a slightly longer version of the
wild
rose?
No, they're not actually like a hip. They're much more like a red currant, really, if you're looking at the berry. So they're juicy. You'll know they're ripe because they'll be a really nice shade of red. They're a little bit more orangey when they're not. And you'll also be able to squish them quite comfortably between your fingers.
And that's the guelder rose?
And that's the guelder rose, yeah.
What else?
Other things we've been finding a lot at the moment is a lot of wild herbs in hedgerows, especially when you're going through chalky ground around Cambridge. So chalky ground at the moment, edges of hedgerow, lots of wild thyme and wild marjoram, which is just beautiful. It's a nice alternative to buying it from the supermarkets.
That sounds lovely. I mean, often people think of wild herbs like that being plentiful in Greece and, you know, hot Mediterranean countries, but we have it here.
We do, yeah, and they're, as long as you know where to look, as I say, chalk ground. So Cambridgeshire is a lot of clay, but when you do find the chalk, and you'll tell that because you'll see the white rocks on the floor,
true,
then start searching and follow your nose.
Mushrooms, perhaps not quite yet.
We've had a little bit of luck with mushrooms. If you follow my page on Facebook, The Foraging Chef, you'll see what we've picked recently. We've had nothing from the meadows at the moment, but from some of the local woodlands only within 5 miles, we've had some lovely prince mushrooms, which are Agaricus augustus. Nice and easy to identify. Anything agaric family, you're looking at smell, you're looking at yellow staining, they're an easy one to learn. They're probably the best beginner mushroom for everyone to learn is the agaric family. So think your field mushrooms, your portobello mushrooms. This is part of that family. So it's been a really good year for the prince mushrooms. We've been having them a lot on the menu. Chicken of the woods, we've got a load more of them through recently. You're looking, really, the best ways to find chicken of the woods if you want to go out looking for them, do river walks. They're a tree fungus, they grow on the edge of trees. You're looking for a bright orange shelf bracket next to rivers. And the other thing we've been finding as well, third and final, is a second flush of Druid saddles. Druid saddles, they're named that because if you see the way they grow off the tree, they almost look like a little chair coming off the edge of the tree.
Oh.
So they're absolutely lovely in flavour. And unless you get them very, very young, they are tough as old boots and not the best eater in that sense. But what they are great for is drying them out, turning them into a powder and then using them to thicken soups and stews and things like that. And it gets a wonderful flavour through. They really do have a great flavour. They're one of my favourites, but they're just the toughness of them. It's just like chewing on an old shoe. So unless you get them very, very young. So you're talking about smaller than the size, maybe up to the size of your fist.
Okay.
Anything bigger than that, dry out. Maybe turn your oven on to pilot light, leave it overnight with a wooden spoon propping the door open, dry it out so it's completely crispy in the blender with some salt. You've got a lovely mushroom seasoning for your chips at home or something.
Sounds really interesting. I think I must go on a mushroom foraging walk with you next time, if at all possible, Steve.
Yeah, we're keeping our eyes open at the moment. The rest of the country is having a lot more luck. If you go over a little bit further, say Thetford way, where the soil's sandier, you can get a lot more mushrooms there. We've started finding some of the bleats. In Cambridgeshire, with the clay soil and the chalk soil, they just struggle to come through. And we're also, people forget, the driest county in the UK.
Yes.
So that doesn't help with mushrooms. So it's probably the hardest mushroom foraging county, but there are some delights out there if you walk enough and look enough.
Thank you so much, Steve. That was absolutely delightful. So follow Steve, the foraging chef. And so that's Steve Thompson of the Green Man Grantchester. And we've been here in Grantchester Meadows.
Thanks a lot, Sue.
Thank you.
Lovely, that. Thanks to Steve Thompson, who will be back next month. Now, on to the Cambridge Market, where I have visited a newish stall, a recently established Battered, specialised in fresh handmade donuts. This is run by a brother and sister team, Josh and Esther. They have a wonderful selection of vegan and non-vegan donuts, the non-vegan aspect being the toppings. And what a variety of toppings they've got. So here they are in their own words.
Sacrilegious.
The Biscoff, the Oreo, the Neapolitan, the Homer and the Snickers.
Those are good basics to have. Everyone loves an Oreo biscuit, and Biscoff is quite trendy at the moment, and it's got a really good richness, and it's just really yummy. Lovely, it's lovely.
Can I just have a box of four and a box of three?
Yep.
Is that okay? So in the box of four, can I have two Biscoff ones and two Neapolitan ones, please?
And the Neapolitan, a lot of children really like that flavour, because it's, if you don't want too much chocolate, or if you don't want too much, if you're not a big fan of biscuits, it's strawberry, vanilla, chocolate and sprinkles, and it's just like that good, it's a good summer flavour as well.
It's a very classic donut flavour. And we've got three non-vegan flavours, which is the Millionaires, the Kinder and the White Reese's. They're £2.50 each and three for £6. We can box them up for you if need be.
Okay, have a think, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
We are a family-run business. We do everything ourselves, and you know, they're all different. And I think people appreciate that. You can go to other donut shops that are, you know, quite popular, but they're all made in a factory. And I think you don't see the love in that. It's just, it is what it is. But with us, we really, really do put our blood, sweat, and tears into it. And because we're able to accommodate people that can't have dairy, and it just means that just because you can't have certain ingredients doesn't mean that you can't also have a donut.
With vegan things, a lot of times places will only have one option, and we try and make our menu as widely available as possible.
One very quick observation about your donuts. Anyone who's interested in the holes are not going to get much value, because the holes, I've noticed, are very small on your donuts.
Yeah.
You get a lot of donut for your money, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
they're a good handful, and they're priced accordingly. You don't always want to spend £5 on a bit of cake or £5 on a donut.
Yeah. Each time we change something, we get a bit more excited about donuts, because a lot of the time you hear about burnout in food communities, that like you taste your own product so much, you get bored a bit. But trying to grow and trying to get better sort of helps that burnout not happen, and we're still excited about donuts, which is quite nice.
Yeah, we're just happy with it, and you know, we've had our kind of a few knocks, and at first it is hard to take when someone's like, well, I didn't like this, I didn't like this, and you can't help but take that a little bit personally, because you literally,
it's
like, that is me.
Yeah.
You know, that donut is pretty much just, you know, my soul. It's just that is everything. That is me on there.
Forbidden donut.
We've got one that's a Millionaire shortbread there.
Yeah.
Obviously it's not a Millionaire shortbread, it's a donut, but we have the caramel, the salty biscuit, you know, like an oaty biscuit, so it's got that saltiness to it, so it's not overly sweet. Because those flavours work. That's a very classic flavour, it's a very classic dessert that a lot of people love. Soft, fluffy dough, it's got...
Yeah, I think that brings up as well that it's not just a flavour thing, it is also a texture thing.
Yeah, we always make sure it's not just soft on soft on soft. We want a bit of a difference, we want a bit of a textural element on there, you know?
It's sort of supposed to be a journey, like, a, not to be too
flavour journey
about it, but it's a journey, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of, every bite is a bit different, you get a bit of everything, but it's, you want to make the donut as exciting as possible.
Yeah, I think so. We used to do a donut that's maple and bacon.
It's a bit of an awkward donut.
Do you know what? It was delicious. You know, maple syrup, pure maple syrup icing, and then we had the smoked bacon on top.
That smoky sweetness is really...
It was
like
just the perfect balance. And it was
probably
one of my one of my favourite donuts. We'll say we've got these in the back, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that not every, you know, we don't want to upset anyone.
Because we obviously keep them all on display,
yeah,
but keep them separate.
Because if you paired that with the Homer, for example, there's your perfect pairing in my head. Yeah, for the cartoon. I mean, that's what he was into, wasn't it? Donuts and bacon.
Yeah, exactly.
Bacon just got a new best friend.
We're always trying
to
just
American
get...
The American
dream. Yeah, exactly. My dream.
Is this your first order, by the way? Have you had this before?
I'm here all the time. All the time. It's a bad habit, isn't it? I try and stop for a while, don't I?
It's been a while, but...
Do you always order the same one?
Always the same ones. All the vegan ones. I do share.
Did you come on the day of the vegan fair and buy,
like
30?
Yeah, that was me. I made everyone have them. I was just like...
we substituted like the eggs, butter and milk for non-dairy products. Instead of eggs, we had chia seeds. You make a jelly out of it, basically, and it's a binding agent.
Yeah.
Some people were a little bit apprehensive at first because you could see them. You couldn't taste them. They had no flavour. They had just a tiny little bite to it, but it wasn't obvious because obviously they're not plain donuts. They've got lots of bits on them, so it wasn't something you could really taste.
You do get a lot of different types of donuts. Like, you get sourdough donuts, and it was sort of like we were trying to see if maybe that would be our brand, and we wanted it to be fluffier and we wanted it to sort of a bit more airy.
You don't need milk and eggs and everything. You don't need the dairy products to make something light and airy and fluffy. And there's so many alternatives now for that kind of stuff. It's a donut. It's got that bit of the second dough that we did, but also a bit of the first. Balance. That's exactly what it is. It's the light and fluffiness, and it's smooth.
Sometimes they'll even do an exclusive donut. You know, sold under the counter. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Say no more.
It's like a bit exclusive, you know, and it's just a bit naughty.
Yeah,
so
it feels underground.
It's just a bit of
like
fun.
An old,
you know,
speakeasy,
I mean?
Donut company.
Yeah, you know, it's just a bit of fun, isn't it? There was like a gentleman yesterday that bought both in one go. We were like, oh, that's a bit savage, you know, not letting anyone else in the world. And like, for instance, today we've got a Ferrero Rocher, a Nutella on there. It's got chocolate sprinkles. It's got white chocolate, milk chocolate, and it's just like really luxurious. And, you know, a Ferrero Rocher is definitely on the kind of the higher end of the types. You know, it's kind of, you treat, you know, you really treat yourself with a Ferrero Rocher. It's that really kind of decadent dessert type feel. We've got a chocolate orange, a lemon drizzle, a maple pecan one, and a maple bacon one. You know, we did a s'mores donut where we put the marshmallows on top and we blowtorched the marshmallows and, you know, put like some nice biscuits around to try and recreate that, and that was a really good one.
Yeah, and
we've got, you know, like the Homer, which is quite classic, coffee and walnut flavour, which is really yummy, and we do like a coffee buttercream, and that's, you know, if you love coffee, you'll love that donut. Mm.
And in the past, we've made vegan brownies and put brownies on top of the donuts, so that was a
really
chocolate
yummy.
Fudge brownie donut. Yeah, they were great.
So much in the world of donuts. We are here at Battered on the Cambridge Market on a Sunday. You're here every Sunday?
We're here every Thursday, Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
And is Thursday specifically a vegan day?
It is, yeah. Vegan Thursdays.
Yeah, so we normally have at least 8 flavours on a Thursday and they're all completely vegan.
It gives us a chance to test ourselves as well.
Yeah.
To really see how adventurous we can get whilst keeping it vegan and keeping it exciting. It's fun.
Well, Esther and Josh, it's been great to meet you. It's a lovely sunny day. Great day for donuts.
Yeah,
thank you
definitely.
So much.
Definitely, thank you very much.
Lovely to meet you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And I'm really going to enjoy being able to insert the word savage in, because we've never been able to use savage in a Flavour interview before.
Savage, yeah, well, it was pretty savage.
Yeah.
I love little comments like that. You know, years from now, when I think back on all the people that we've met doing this programme, I'm always going to remember Esther and her use of the word savage. Well, savage. And Battered are going from strength to strength. They've recently signed up with the Just Eat delivery service, you know, because there's plenty of people who are stuck at work whilst Battered are selling their donuts on the market. So your favourite donuts can be picked up fresh and delivered wherever you are around the city. And they also do large events like weddings and birthdays. They cater to offices. So do check out their Instagram, is what I'm saying, for examples of their work. Their Instagram handle is @batteredofficial.com. And there's the familiar music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city for today, Saturday. Bacchanalia, the beer and wine importer, are tweeting with plenty of new tequila and mezcal, gins and whiskies to choose from this weekend because they wanted to help you take advantage of this glorious sunny weather we've got. Definitely time for some G&Ts, margaritas and drams, they say. And redefining rubbish cooking, finally. Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern in Regent Street is launching Rubbish Cooks. Now, this is to inspire and educate on food waste in the industry. This is his new monthly supper club. It's going to take place on the last Monday of every month, serving a three-course meal, £20 per person, and £5 of that goes to Jimmy's shelter. If that sounds fun, you can email inquiries@parkerstavern.com. And don't forget, you can keep up with what we are tweeting by following us at Flavour105.
Well, a new wine shop has opened in Cambridge, a rather unusual one, as I found out when I spoke to owner Matt Hodgson.
Yes, it's actually a wine shop and wine bar that specialises in English and Welsh wines.
What brought you to being involved?
I've seen that the quality and indeed the quantity and choice is just expanding all the time. Basically, I had a former career as a tax accountant before moving into the wine industry. And I thought, I want to be part of the wine industry that's actually a really dynamic part and a part that's close to home. The English wine industry is those things. It's a really rapidly growing industry.
You've only just opened in Cambridge 6 weeks ago, I gather.
That's absolutely right, Sue, yes. It was around the turn of this year that I decided I was finally going to take the plunge. So I spent the first months of this year travelling extensively around the country, visiting these vineyards, tasting some of these lovely, lovely wines, making sure I had the best ones for the shop, and getting myself ready to launch. It's been a really exciting time, actually, and the reception from the local community since we opened has been absolutely fantastic. It's funny, I think in the wine trade itself, it's quite accepted that the quality of English wine, particularly English sparkling wine, is absolutely world class. But, you know, that message isn't necessarily got out there to everyone. So actually part of what I'm doing here is, and I don't mean this to sound too funny, but it's almost a mission to introduce people to English wine and let them see what's out there now. And I've been absolutely delighted with the response, actually, that we've had from the customers.
Sparkling wine, yes, English sparkling wine. What about white, rosé and red English wines?
That's a great question. I mean, England is most renowned for its sparkling wines that regularly beat champagnes in blind tastings. But the still wines is something that's been getting better and better year on year. Again, it's partly to do with the climate. As things have got warmer, we're much better able to produce really high quality white, rosé and even red wines. The other thing is that the industry itself is maturing, so the knowledge within the industry of how to make high quality still wines has grown incredibly over the past few years as well.
Sometimes people have this idea for English wines that they are rather more expensive than other European or American or Australian or whatever wines. Is that so? And if so, why do you think that is?
The industry simply doesn't have the economies of scale that you get in some of these other places that you're mentioning. But what I would say is, at any given price point, I think the quality you get for that price in England would be at least as good as elsewhere. And I think one of the reasons behind that, Sue, is that the English wine industry is full of quite small producers, artisans, if you like. People are very passionate about their product. It's not the case that it's all mass market, mass produced. It's typically families who are running these businesses, and they have gone into it often because it is a passion and a hobby for them, as well as hopefully making some money out of it.
What are your plans for making yourself known in the Cambridge area?
Well, that's interesting. We've taken a quite soft launch sort of approach. Just been winding down my previous career and taking baby steps into the new one. We're very keen to become bedded in the local community. As I said earlier, we've had a fantastic reception. So we're holding tasting events in the evenings. We're going to start offering food, so cheese boards, charcuterie and such like. And yeah, we're very happy to host groups here. We've got a book group coming in next Thursday, for example. But beyond that, you know, I've got all sorts of ideas fizzing around my head, to be absolutely honest. We're going to look to moving into supplying restaurants and colleges. And who knows, maybe another venue somewhere. But these are all for the future, Sue.
Considering that you've only been here 6 weeks, you've got shelves full of really interesting bottles of wine. Some sweet wines I can see, or a whole range of rosés, Prosecco alternatives.
Absolutely right. We've actually got over 160 English and Welsh wines on our shelves now, which is the most of anyone in the entire country. We have the largest stock. As you say, like, the great thing is, these days, there is something in every style you could look for. All the stills, the dessert wines you spotted there, some fantastic, really complex, botrytized dessert wines there. But of course, there's always the wonderful sparklers, which everyone keeps coming back to for those celebration occasions.
Yes.
I think that one of the great things about this shop is that it offers people those perhaps better known brands, but indeed that opportunity to sample something a little bit different and hopefully something local.
I am actually now sampling one of the wines at Great Britannia, and it's an Albourne Estate Sandstone Ridge.
So, Sue, this is actually a blended wine. So it's from the 2018 vintage, which was a stunning year for English wines. You can probably all remember the summer we had, which really helps grapes get to full phenolic ripeness and express their flavours fantastically. So this one's a blend of three grapes: Chardonnay, which is probably familiar to a lot of people, Pinot Blanc, which is another French grape, if I can call it that, but then one that lots of people may not have heard of called Ortega, which is actually a grape that was bred by scientists in Germany. So it was a cross of various other different grape varieties. The grapes together combine really well, and they get this really complex range of flavours. So there's honeysuckle, jasmine and peach in there. Also, even I get a little hint of fresh coconut and vanilla. But if all that sounds a little bit tropical and sickly, it's actually a really quite dry, crisp wine underneath all of that.
And some people slurp.
Good. Some people will even get a little hint of white pepper on the end of it as well.
Again, if you'd have said to me that's an English wine, I'd have said, I don't care what it is, it tastes really, really good. It's got a really nice roundness. It's not too heavy. It's light, but not too light. And it's got a really, as you say, a really complex range of flavours there. And that's absolutely lovely. And you're selling it by the glass.
Absolutely. We always have at least six wines by the glass each week, and we rotate it every week. You know, I'm just so keen to give people a chance to try the different English wines, so there'll always be something new there for people to try.
Thank you. That was Grape Britannia, and if you want to know where they're located, it is on the corner of Milton Road and Arbury Road, literally just around the corner. Rather lovely shop, beautifully bright, open and very friendly and welcoming. And do you have a Twitter and website?
Absolutely, we're at Grape Britannia on Twitter and on Facebook and also on Instagram. And our website is www.greatbritannia.co.uk.
And Green Onion signals the start of our new section. We begin with jobs.
Jobs galore in Market Passage, where Tabouche is looking for full and part-time staff. Drop your CV off there or email it to info@tabouche.co.uk. Also in Market Passage, Barouche has full and part-time positions for front of house and also for chefs. Hand in your CV over the counter or email barouche.cambridge@macmullan.co.uk.
And good luck if you're applying for one of those positions. Please let them know that you heard about it on Flavour. And if you are looking for staff and you'd like to advertise in this slot, you can email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
There's an event coming up at Great Britannia. On 29th of September, there's a Belgian brewer tasting. It's from 8 till 10 p.m. and the tasting is free and the beers are also available to buy. Details are on the Great Britannia website where you can also book. Great Britannia is at 1A Arbury Road, just off Milton Road.
And there's another wine event coming up. This one organised by the Cambridgeshire Wine School and is at the Royal Cambridge Hotel in Trumpington Street. The cost is £35 for two people, £20 for one, and it's a walk-around tasting with wines from Cambridge wine merchants, Noel Young, Thorn Wines, Vine and Cork, Grape Britannia, Thirsty and others. And this event is also on the 29th. Details can be found on the Cambridgeshire Wine School website. There's a 2 to 4pm event and an evening one from 5 to 7. Tickets are available for both. And that's Charlotte from Flavour Today. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sundays at 2, and then podcast early in the next week, where you can expect to hear some slightly longer versions of some of these features. Classical Cambridge is up next, followed by Polish Waves at 5. But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 28th of September. So until then,
goodbye.